For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Every team, every topic, everywhere. This is Believe.
Hello and welcome to Gegenpressing, the Bundesliga podcast. This is episode 400, at least we believe. I'm your host, Manu Feit. He's Stefan Biankowski. And Stefan, wow, 400 episodes. It is definitely at least 400 episodes. We have it somewhere written down at this number 400. So we're just going to go with that. 400 episodes is a milestone. Incredible. We've got to talk about, I guess. But first, before we get into all of that, I'm just kind of speechless because I didn't really ever think, like, when this podcast was founded in November 2017, that we would get to 400 episodes.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it?
It is crazy. It is absolutely bonkers. 400 episodes, and it's going strong. It's probably stronger than ever. So yeah, we're probably going to do this soon again with number 500. But we'll get there when the time comes, I guess. How is it going with you, first of all?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good. Maybe we can do like a big event on episode 500, like a live show in New York or something like that. That'd be fun. Maybe I don't know how many episodes we do a year. I guess we do maybe about 50 a year, maybe. So
it's more now, isn't it? I mean, like when I first started this, it was like one a week. And then, you know, we added the preview.
Yeah, true.
And now it's four. But I guess the ones behind the paywall don't count. I'm not sure.
Yeah, we're not counting the bonus ones because they don't go on the main feed. So, but yeah, still two a week. So yeah, you're right. We might hit 500 next week or next year rather. But that's a question for then. For now, we've got lots of questions to answer.
This kind of makes it sound like we have lots of questions to answer. This is like the kind of wording that I got whenever I did something bad at home when I was young. You have a lot to answer for, mister. But yes, as you mentioned, we post this basically to our subscribers at the Substack. They asked them to send us questions for number 400, and we got lots and lots of questions. Some of them, if we didn't answer them, like I think, Stefan, maybe off the top, we got a few questions about the German national team. And some of them about the current setup, right? There is questions about Stuttgart, and we answered that in the main show earlier this week. So I want to refer to that. But also, I think you and I want to do a deep dive on Germany anyways. You know, there's two games coming up against France and the Netherlands. And, you know, once we have... I don't know what Nagelsmann is going to reveal on Thursday because most of the squad is leaked. But, you know, once we get closer to that date through the national team games, I think it's better to answer those questions then. I think that's a much better plan.
Yeah, definitely. We could have easily spent a full hour talking about the national team instead of answering maybe more personal questions, which I guess more people would probably prefer for this show. So there are still some football questions I'm going to answer. But if you ask a German national team question, we will get to it at some point, just not on this show.
Yep, absolutely. All right, let's dive into it, shall we?
Yeah, so first question comes from Skeletor83, who says, did you both play football growing up? And if so, what level?
Yes, the answer is yes, I did play football. I played football competitively in Germany, England, and the Netherlands. And it was in the Netherlands that I played the highest level. It's kind of difficult to answer what that highest level was, because in the Netherlands, Stefan, they split the league between Catholics and Protestants. You don't have to be Protestant or Catholic to play in one of those teams. It's just traditionally, you know, that's where the origin is. So there's what they call a Saturday League and a Sunday League. Obviously, the Saturday League is for the teams that are traditionally Catholic because they couldn't play on a Sunday, right? So this is anything below, I think it's now the third division or fourth division, because they changed Dutch football quite a bit since I played there. It's more than, it's 13 years ago now, right? Okay. And it was called the fifth division. So like the fifth division. And I played on a Saturday team, which means the team I played for called Huizen Middenmeer was Catholic. I don't think there was a single Catholic person on that team.
I've played all my life. I was obsessed with football as a kid. I never played for an actual team until high school. I played for my school team. Then went to university and got into the university team. Well, not the first 11, which they called it, but I think in first year... I got through the trials, which I was quite proud of, because about 500 or 600 people, I think, applied to get into the team, and they did like these sporting trials. I got through them all. But then they were like, it costs like £5,000 a year to be a member of the club. I was like, well...
Holy smokes.
I think I'd much rather just sit in the student union drinking beers at the weekends, to be honest. So I gave that up. And yeah, I've still played. We have 5-a-sides here in the UK, which I used to play a lot of. I preferred that to Saturday football because I did used to play 11-a-sides at the weekend. My brother used to run a team, and I had some friends who ran teams I would help out with, but it was just too kind of physical, too aggressive. It was more a case of kind of old men trying to slide tackle you and break your legs more than actually anything resembling real football. So I kind of packed it in, and that was the extent of my footballing career. But yeah, when I was a kid, I was desperate to be a footballer. I was really obsessed with it. What's the old saying? If you can't do, teach. And I guess if you can't play football, you can report on it.
Become a journalist. I don't play anymore. I had a couple of knee surgeries and both my ankles. I did my ankle twice playing competitively in the Netherlands. And since the other goalkeeper broke his hand, we taped that ankle for the entire season, which, oh, yikes. Do not recommend that at all, because it turned out the ligament was completely torn.
my knees, you could hear my knees through a wall the way every time I sit up or kneel down, because it just clicked because of the old days of football. But
my ankle
anyway,
does
moving
that.
On. Skelter has another question. He says, what are some of the best Bundesliga single game performances either of you remember or in Bundesliga history, not counting anything done by Lewandowski at Dortmund or Bayern? I must admit, I misread this and I went away and thought of it. And my first thought was, in fact, Lewandowski against Real Madrid, that's the one that always comes to mind for me as a moment of just insane individual talent. And if I had to think off the top of my head, the one player that actually maybe comes to mind who wasn't at Dortmund or Bayern was Marco Reus that season at Gladbach. I think his final season at Gladbach. I can't think of a specific game, but that comes to mind. And then, of course, I think the only other player I can think of instead of Dortmund and Bayern who's really impressed me since then maybe is maybe Florian Wirtz actually this season or last season. He's just been incredible. But I think you maybe have a better prepared answer for this one.
Yeah, so I thought about this long and hard and I put down some examples. There was a bunch of performances that Ailton had in 2003-2004 for Werder Bremen when they won the championship, right? He scored 28 goals, I think, that season.
Yeah,
And I thought that was absolutely fantastic. That Kaffeecher game against Bayern Munich when Wolfsburg won the title, and you know he scored that JJ Okocha-like goal, which brings me straight to JJ Okocha because he had that phenomenal game against Karlsruhe where he scored against future Bayern goalkeeper Oliver Kahn. So those were some of them that came to mind. But the one that really stuck out to me is actually a really tragic figure in German football, and that's Olaf Bodden, 1860 striker who in 95-96 had a phenomenal year, scored 14 goals, and then had he got sick with mono and he never really recovered from that, and he's actually still really really sick. He thought he had recovered, came back and scored a beautiful, like actually a German-style hat-trick, you know, three in a row in one half-time against Arminia Bielefeld in 1997. And we all thought, okay, well, he's back and he's healthy again. And then unfortunately, he was not. And that was his last big performance for 1860 ever. But that single game against Bielefeld, where he scored that hat-trick, stood out to me. And that was actually another game that he had a similar performance. And that was in the, you remember the old UE Cup, the UI Cup? You know, that qualifying tournament that they did? Germans call it UE Cup. Obviously, it's UI Cup. And UEFA Intertoto Cup is the full name for it. And he, this was one of the first games I saw live with my dad in stadium. This was in 1996, and Olaf Bodden scored four goals in a 5-0 win against LKS Lodz, Polish side, at the old Grünwalder Stadion. And that was just a phenomenal, phenomenal game by him. So this was a pure goal scorer. He was really good. Unfortunately, his career ended way too early. But yeah, that's one that still to this day, those two games I remember.
Yeah, that's a really good answer. It makes up for my lack of an answer, so thank you very much for that. I'm just going to keep firing through these because we would get bogged down, but we've got so many good questions. Next one comes from Justin. He says, I've always wondered where your footballing heart lies, Stefan. We know about Manu and 1860, but there's a Scottish club or other that you love or once loved. Yeah, good question. A lot of people ask me, you know, if I do support a German football team, and the answer is I do not. I just chalk it up to my own personality, but I kind of started covering German football around the time of Klopp's Dortmund side. And, you know, don't get me wrong, I was certainly cheering for them in the Champions League final against big bad Bayern, just about anyone outside of Munich, really, around the world.
And most of Munich.
But I would have never, I never called myself a Dortmund fan by any means. And maybe that's just because I think a lot of people from the UK and the US and around the world flocked to Dortmund at that time, that I kind of thought, well, you know, I'm not just going to follow the crowd, so I've never really done that. And professionally as well, I've always just found myself kind of just enjoying different teams at time. Players, coaches, and I've never really felt a strong affinity to any of these teams, even to the point that, you know, I lived just outside Cologne for the best part of 2 years, and I never really felt a strong bond with them either, funnily enough. In terms of Scotland, yeah, I do. I support Queen's Park, a team who play in the second tier of Scottish football. They're really fun club who are based in the south side of Glasgow, which is where I'm from, and they're steeped in history. The oldest club in Scotland, I think they're the second or third oldest club in the world, actually. People may know them from the fact that they play at Hampden Park in Glasgow. That's my club, really. I can't say I go every week. I don't live in Glasgow anymore, so obviously I can't, but I do try to go to as many games as I can. And it's in a fun part of town now, so it's always good for a drink as well. For a wee night out and a few drinks. So that's my club.
Nice, great answer. You can actually see it on your profile on Transfermarkt too, right?
Yes, you can. Yeah. I grew up in a family. This is the kind of thing that people don't really understand, because if you're from Glasgow, people just assume you support Celtic or Rangers. But my dad could not care less about football. He has no interest in it. He'd much rather be out fishing or something like that, or, you know, just doing stuff outdoors. He's never had any interest in football. So, you know, me and my brother never grew up having that kind of... Because most people inherit their football team from the parents, usually their father, and we just never had that. So we were kind of left our own accord. My brother gravitated towards Celtic, and he's a huge Celtic fan now. And I kind of dabbled in sports in Celtic as a kid, but by the time I was kind of, you know, old enough to kind of start making my own decisions and old enough to kind of make my own choices, I'd actually started supporting Queen's Park because my uncle was a season ticket fan there, and we used to go with him to watch Queen's Park every Saturday from the age of maybe 12 or 13. So Yeah, I supported them, and they have they used to have these great away tops. So they were sponsored by this team called Iron, this energy drink called Iron Brew, which anyone who's been to Scotland will know. I'm sure you've tried it before, man.
Yeah, it's a national drink.
National drink. So they were famously sponsored by Iron Brew, and the sponsorship meant that their strip was this kind of bright orange and bright blue, which is the colours of Iron Brew. It's called the Iron Brew top, and I used to get that top every year, and I loved it. I absolutely adored it as a kid. So yeah, that's my bizarre footballing background, which, you know, as a result means that I don't really have to support any of the big teams in the big leagues.
It does help not supporting any clubs in the leagues that you cover. Which be the Bundesliga, we can say we love all 18 clubs equally.
Yeah, exactly. Especially Augsburg.
Yeah, sure.
So next question is from Anders, who asks, who did ask a question about the German national team, but as I said, we'll try and cover that in a different episode. Yeah. Congratulations on the 400th episode. I'd like you guys talk. I feel like you guys talk about football so much that I pose a non-football question. I myself am a huge movie fan, so I'm curious to hear some of you guys' favorite films. I don't really believe in one favorite film, so maybe you can mention a couple.
Yeah, Stefan, I watched Dune yesterday, the second one, and I'm still in awe. What a fantastic, fantastic second film. I mean, the first one was already so great. So obviously my bias is, I love anything science fiction. And, you know, Dune is the origin of anything. You know, Star Wars is basically just a ripoff of that. Anyone who reads books knows this. But I also love film noir. And one of my favorite films actually is Eastern Promises with Viggo Mortensen.
Oh, wow.
And of course, one of the reasons is I have a background in Russian and Soviet history, right? I have a PhD in Soviet history. I lived in the post-Soviet space for a few years, you know, Ukraine and Russia, and spent some time in Georgia as well and some other post-Soviet states. So, you know, obviously when that was a film that had a huge impression on me, it's, you know what Eastern Promise is about, right? You've seen it?
Yeah, I think I have, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, it's essentially about the Russian mafia in London, and Viggo Mortensen is, I think he's an FSB agent who's infiltrated this mafia. Anyways, fantastic. And of course, Viggo Mortensen being Viggo Mortensen, actually spent time in Siberia with the Russian mafia to actually get involved, to learn about his role, which is, seems a very Viggo Mortensen thing to do. But that's one of my favorite movies. And I also love the original Blade Runner. And I actually think they did a really good job with the second Blade Runner too, which I think is also Denis Villeneuve.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Canadian treasure. Born in Quebec, of course. So, yeah. I thought they did a really good job with the second Blade Runner. But the original Blade Runner with Harrison Ford is one of my all-time favorite movies.
Yeah, it's a great film, actually. Blade Runner was one of my favorites as well, growing up as well, and I totally agree with you. I actually have another Denis Villeneuve movie, but I was trying to think of what films still stand out to me. And I think as an adult, the one that really stands out is like the one that had the biggest impact on me was actually Arrival by Denis Villeneuve, the sci-fi film. And actually, I was chatting to my wife about it after we watched Dune 2 and like how many influences that movie's had on Dune itself. Even to the design of some of the spaceships, actually.
Totally.
I can pretty. I'm just trying to rattle my brain for ones that come to mind. I mean, I just wanted to make a brief kind of shout out to Studio Ghibli. I love those films. The Japanese kind of animation films. Spirited Away is probably the most famous one. I don't know why, but they've always kind of held a kind of lovely like place in my heart. My wife still hasn't got around to the idea. I was really hoping to take her to see the latest one, The Boy and the Heron, which but the cinema times have been all over the place since it came out, but I adore those. But if I had to pick, you know, three films to take with me to a desert island, it would undoubtedly be the Lord of the Rings extended edition trilogy, which my wife and I watch every single year. And they're about 12 hours long, and I honestly don't think I could overstate just the impact those films have had on my life. My wife came down the aisle to the breaking of the fellowship by Howard Shore, which is one of the main songs from the first film, played on the harp. And yeah, we're both just mega, mega Lord of the Rings fans. So we watch those every year, and those are undoubtedly my favorite. I mean, I could name a million films that I adore, but I'd be lying if I said anything came close to those. So those are my three favorite films, I would say.
Yeah, my guilty pleasure would be Arnold Schwarzenegger films. I watch all of them repeatedly. I recently rewatched Predator, and I was like, oh my God, this film is still good. but yeah, have you been to New Zealand then yet?
No. I have a few friends who've gone out there and done the kind of tours and things. I'd love to go sometime, but just haven't really had the time to do it. But it costs a lot of money. I had a friend who recently went on their honeymoon, and you're getting in the thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds for it. So
yeah, it makes sense. There's Vancouver, you can fly direct from Vancouver to New Zealand. And I always, when I fly to Europe, there's always a few people that connect in Vancouver to get to Europe from New Zealand. I'm like, oh my God, gosh, you have 2 9-hour legs.
Yeah. I think I saw something recently that like LA or Vancouver to either New Zealand or Australia is like the longest journey you can do without seeing land in a plane. It can mess with your head, apparently.
It does when I fly to Hawaii, because it's a 6 to 7 hour flight and you're only over water.
Yeah, no thank you. Next question. D. Schallenberger asks, I'm curious, I heard rumors that in 2012 the reason Germany did not do so well the Euros is because the team was splintered with Bayern Dortmund players. If so, how did that get fixed for the 2014 World Cup run? Manu, you're welcome to take a stab at this one, because I'm not entirely sure I can actually answer it.
Long answer short, they put him in a fancy camp in the jungle in Brazil, right? I think it was far more complicated than Bayern and Dortmund players not getting along. From what I remember in 2012, there was, there was so many different little issues. And at the end of the day, I don't think Germany didn't win the Euros in 2012 because the squad was fragmented, but because Jogi Löw had the brilliant idea of making Toni Kroos, what was it again? He put him on Andrea Pirlo, right? Mm-hmm. As a man marker. What a stupid idea. That's why Germany lost to Italy. We also have to remember they almost turned that game around in the end, right? So I don't think the fragmentation was something that was obviously brought up in the media when the team didn't win. But I think, tournaments are so tricky to get the chemistry right with the squad and to also then have results go your way and not make a mistake in a single elimination is so very difficult to achieve. I think that the Dortmund-Bayern thing was definitely overstated in 2012. And in Brazil, everything went right from the setup, to this idea to put them in a camp and then fragment the squad because they were all put in different rooms, but not one team at a time, right? I think they just got it right, which is really hard to do because in Russia, for example, 4 years later, they got it completely wrong, right? So I think this is probably the most underrated thing about tournament predictions is not necessarily the squad depth or strength, because all these teams are really good. And at the end of the day, you can only really field 11 guys, right? It's really what environment you create for the players. And I think that's what Germany has for the most time in their history gotten right. And then maybe in the last three tournaments has gotten completely wrong.
I think that's a spot on answer. And I've not really got much else to add to it, so I'll move on to the next question. Matthew asks, if you woke up with the power to make three changes to rules, culture, or philosophies of the Bundesliga DFL, entirely unchallenged that you think would improve the state of German football, what would you do? It can also just be one to not take up too much time. That's very gracious of you, Matthew. Anything come to mind for you?
Allow videos on social media.
Yeah. I think that would single-handedly lead to the offices of the Bundesliga in Cologne bursting into flame.
That's one. I also would bring back, I would roll back Bosman.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why would you do that?
I see it in North American sports. You know, here players can't just pack up and leave. You know, the moment the contract runs up, you have to turn to a certain age before free agency fully hits. And I feel like it leads to more loyalty by the players. You know, we had an example now in Vancouver, different sport, you know, hockey, where the star player, although, you know, there's other attractive markets out there, just signed another 8-year contract after being here already for many years, right? I think we need to give some power back to the clubs. I hate this because I'm a unionist and I believe in freedom of movement and all that sort of stuff, but these players make millions of euros. You know, it's not like you and me, Stefan, when we decide, you know, we want to just leave. In fact, we can't just leave either. It's not necessarily that easy. You know, I just think I would like to see clubs having the ability to put squads together and go on longer runs together.
That's really interesting. It would obviously have a huge impact on football. And
yeah.
I think Bosman
it's never going to
changed,
happen.
Yeah,
never
I think Bosman has completely changed the face of football to the point now where we're getting to the point where, you know, players have so much control. Like you look at Mbappe, for example, at PSG and how much power he has there and how much power Haaland has when he moved to Dortmund and still has arguably, probably even though he's at Manchester City.
But Bellingham, he was under contract and he could just say, oh, look, if it's either this year or not at all. You know, and I don't know. I don't know how I feel about it. And the thing is, Stefan, too, I think it gives a lot of power to the agents, not necessarily even to the players.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, isn't it? I think a lot of people, you know, the ruling was probably the best intentions. And I mean, I think on the whole, it still does a lot of good. But we have seen this kind of emergence of kind of the agent class who, you know, have gone from strength to strength. And you can see that UEFA and FIFA are now trying to kind of reel that in with new rules and regulations. And a lot of these agents now have to be officially signed up through FIFA and UEFA portals. Maybe they're just, we'll have to wait and see what happens, but it feels a bit like they're trying to put the genie back in the bottle there.
So hard.
In terms of what I would do to change German football overnight, I was kind of thinking about this one, you know, whether you would change youth football or whether you'd try and change cultural things. And one thing that did pop into my head was just the way that so many clubs are just steeped in their local ecosystems, in the sense that, like, you know, we've talked about this before, like clubs like Cologne and Schalke and Hamburg, that they're so almost bogged down by the just sheer bureaucracy of the number of local businesses and, you know, power brokers involved, and whether you could kind of flush all that out. But something far more interesting, I think, would make a big difference to Bundesliga would be if you just split Bayern Munich into two clubs. And I've got the real reason behind this is that if you actually look at the geography of German football and, you know, where the money is in Germany and where the clubs are, it's clear that Bayern kind of enjoy and more or less monopoly over the kind of, you know, the southeast of the country, obviously Bavaria. I mean, they are literally FC Bavaria. So, you know, it makes sense, but it's basically a state club up against regional clubs in Germany. And I think that's obviously why historically, and it's why they eventually kind of rose to the top and why now they are a tier above the rest of the clubs. And I know people are going to probably be saying it to the earphones right now, and I'm sure you're about to say yourself, Manu, that there already is a second club in Munich, but, you know, for one reason or another, that hasn't really quite worked out. It never really has since, what, the 60s or 70s, maybe, last time Munich did, two clubs were on a parity with each other. And I just think if you had two clubs in Munich, the way that there's two clubs in Manchester, you know, you see it in, obviously, two clubs in Madrid, I mean, you know, it's not to say that it would obviously lead to two clubs always being at the same level, but we're talking about an extremely hypothetical situation here where, you know, best case scenario and all these things. And if you could make two clubs in Munich the size of, you know, a Dortmund and a Schalke, or, you know, a Stuttgart or a Hamburg and a Bremen, I think that would immediately make the Bundesliga far more competitive, and it'd be very interesting as well, because you'd suddenly have a really interesting Munich derby that we could actually watch from season to season, which unfortunately we can't do now. And I just think it would, and to kind of bring it back to that kind of power brokers thing, the success of Bayern Munich off the pitch is that there's so many huge German companies that we all know around the world based in Munich, and they naturally gravitate to association with Munich, with Bayern.
Hasn't always been the case, but it's definitely now.
But could you imagine we split Bayern in two and we say, right, half of these clubs, half of these companies that put so much money into Bayern every year have to go with the new club, and we even it out, and suddenly have two very strong, two very well founded clubs in Munich. And I don't know. I mean, you're the boy from Munich, so you tell me if you think it would work.
I think many of the Bundesliga's problems would be solved if 1860 is back in the Bundesliga. First and foremost, all of my problems. But no, I think you raise a really good point here, and we have to also remember, right, that Man City is an artificial construct the way it is today. But you know, there is something to be said about the Premier League's ability to allow investors to come in and fix a club, right? 1860, of course, has an investor, just the wrong one. But, I do think that there is lots of rich people, actually, in Munich that would love to help 1860. It's just that they got themselves into such a messy situation with Hasan Ismail that they can't really do it. There was, in fact, one of the people that works directly with BMW, one of the subsidiary companies of BMW, one of the largest manufacturer of car parts, right? And there's lots of companies like that in Germany. There's lots of billion euro companies that you've never heard of in Germany. That's what Germany is famous for. And he wanted to actually buy out Ismail. The problem is Ismail is not selling. No, you can't even buy the guy out. We can't get rid of him. And so, of course, I would love there to be mechanisms, and, you know, like that gets us into 50+1, and that debate is hot. But I would love there to be mechanisms that would allow companies to maybe insert bigger influence without the ultras throwing tennis balls right away, because I do think it would actually help breaking up Bayern Munich's monopoly. And the funny thing is, Stefan, Bayern Munich would be the first club to welcome this.
Yeah, well, they probably want even more money from the likes of Audi and Allianz and things.
I think the way they see it is that a more competitive league will make them more money.
Yeah, no, of course. And, you know, without going into a whole, you know, go down a rabbit hole on 50+1 and what you and Matt have talked about extensively, but there are, as you said, companies around the country that are probably just waiting for the opportunity to put money into the clubs that they have, you know, whether that's Dortmund, Hamburg, Bremen, Stuttgart's a good example, obviously, with Mercedes. Yeah, it's a totally interesting thing, and it's maybe something that, as you and Matt talked about on the last big podcast, is maybe something that's on the horizon, and maybe something that a lot of these kind of these clubs will consider down the line, as a way to almost circumnavigate 50+1. But yeah, no, it's very interesting. We could totally do an episode on this question alone. So, thank you very much for the question. Hugo has a big question about Kai Havertz, which we did agree to talk about before the show, but I'm there wondering if this would actually also be better suited for the German national team.
He's so good, like he's scoring goals like fun. But yeah,
he is indeed. Do you want to do it now, or do I do it on the national team?
I am also writing something on it for Transfermarkt, and I do think that maybe we It's a really, really, really good question. Maybe let's shelf it and talk about it in more in depth, because I want to look at his numbers too. But, you know, he is the way he's playing right now, we have been wondering who could play for Germany at the Euros as a number 9. And I think the answer right now is quite easily Kai Havertz.
Yeah, exactly. We could do a whole episode on him, which we might well do. And just again to reiterate, there's an international break coming up. We will definitely be doing Germany. Do not worry. maybe multiple episodes actually on the German national team. And of course, we'll be throughout summer as well with the Euros. So bear with us, guys, because we did get a lot of questions about, can you guys cover the German national team? We do appreciate that. We don't get the opportunity to often do it, but we will. Anyway, shall I move on to more questions?
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
So Tommy says, I've always wondered this about covering sports. Has it been hard for you guys to still be football fans while also covering the sport as a job? I know that I have days at work that are stressful or drag on, but I can go home and unplug. With most games being on nights and weekends, how do you keep that work-life balance? It's a really good question.
And it's not an easy answer. I mean, I didn't have the easiest time right around Christmas, you know why, but that was definitely a point in my life where I had enough of football. And I had anything but football in mind, and it was definitely just a job. And, you know, there is been points like that. I'm sure there has been for you as well, Stefan. And I think the trick there is to really find, you know, I went away for a week to Hawaii and basically didn't do anything football related. And that really helped. And also, you know, having hobbies that have nothing to do with football. You know, it turns out both you and I watch a lot of films, so that helps. I am a huge hockey fan. I watch a lot of hockey games in my free time. I find that is because I can just sit on the couch and I don't have to worry about writing a match report, an analysis, or do a podcast on it. It's me and my mates watching hockey, right? But there's definitely been points for me where I'm like, I don't enjoy the sport right now. I don't know how it's been for you.
You know, I'm always reminded of quite a funny joke in Friends, the TV show, when one of the female characters is going out with a gynecologist, and I think it's Joey who's obviously making a joke about, you know, what's it like being a male gynecologist and dating a woman. And he makes a really interesting analogy where he says, you know, I work in a coffee shop, and sometimes when I go home, the last thing I want to see is another cup of coffee. Is it the same being a gynecologist? And it's obviously meant to be a joke, and he makes it, and the gynecologist says obviously not. But that is sometimes the case with football. When you write about football, you cover football. I typically watch maybe 4, 5, 6 games a weekend. At this point in the year, I'm also probably watching 2 or 3 games through the week. Yeah, I think escapism is a really important part of this job. I often get people asking, you know, when I go on city breaks with my wife, you know, oh, did you go to see so and so, or did you go to that club and go to one of their games? And no, I never do, because the last thing I want to do at holidays is go to a football game. And unfortunately, it also kind of bleeds into a lot of things. You know, I simply do not read football books ever. There's a handful of books that I've read. There's some that I always enjoy when I do read them, but I have a huge bookshelf of books, and I'd say probably 90% of them are history books and sci-fi books. That's because I'm seeking escapism away from football. And to be quite frank, I think people who cover football full time and then go home and read football books, or on their days off go to football games, or potentially psychopaths, to be perfectly honest with you. So it's not because I don't like football or because I've fallen out of love with it. And there have been periods when I have fallen out of love with football. It's almost actually cyclical, maybe. You know, my first stint covering football in Germany, I definitely kind of fell out of love with German football to a large extent. And decided I needed a break. I went back to cover Scottish football for the BBC, and I then, after covering that for what, 2 or 3 years, I also kind of fell out of love with that, because covering that league in particular came with a whole avalanche of personal abuse on social media on a weekly basis. You know, you're just at that level on a platform like the BBC, writing articles and covering the sport. It just meant your Twitter account was just bombarded with stuff on a weekly basis, which I just despised. And returning to German football after that was such a kind of lovely godsend in that sense, because everyone's just so polite and friendly, and we've obviously got this wonderful community of people around the world who love talking about it. And that itself has actually probably been the a really nice kind of palate cleanser for me after a hard week, that you could obviously just jump into the chat and people are having conversations and enjoying it. So I would definitely say, if you're trying to get into sports journalism, or if you're cover football, you know, for a blog or a YouTube channel or a podcast or anything, and you want to make it a full-time job, then all power to you. But it is really important to make sure you do have things that allow you to think about other things, because it's just healthy to have other things that allow you to escape from your obsessions. And B, I often find that my inspirations for what I want to write about or do videos about or whatever else or do podcasts about come about from me when I step out of the box and I read a book about Napoleon or a sci-fi book about, you know, the Foundation series from Isaac Asimov or something like that. When I'm reading these things, the style of writing and the approach to their topics are so different that it just completely, it's like a palate cleanser, and it just completely refreshes my mind. And that's such a huge important part for me, I think.
It's a work-life balance is hugely important, right? Like, yeah. I started competitive cycling a few years ago because, like, in competitive cycling, you sometimes spend 3 or 4 hours on your bike, sometimes more, right? And listening to music when you're on a road bike is not safe. So it's just you. It's literally just you on the road, right? And sometimes you know, there's a couple guys that I ride with here. So you have friends who you ride with, and you talk to them, obviously. But even, you know, then there's large times where you're just with you in your head. I find that really positive, you know, and that's really, really important, because it also removes you. You mentioned social media, which has become such a poisonous thing. And you know, being away from that is, I think, really important, because at some point, you know, we're not famous by any means, but you're still a public person, right? So like having that safety valve is, I find, really important.
Yeah, I totally agree. But I do a lot of hill walking. That's another thing it's maybe worth adding. Like, if you were to look through my list of podcasts I listen to, I'd say maybe less than 10% are actually football as well. I do listen to certain ones to kind of keep on top of things, and there's some excellent ones out there as well that I thoroughly recommend. They're just fun, interesting, intriguing. But I find myself kind of listening to other things entirely, and that's why I stick on. If I'm on like a 3 or 4 hour hill walk or something, you know, I'm not listening to football all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. No, definitely. Like, it's a balance, right? I think the best analysis is here really that you don't want to take your job home. You know, yeah, whether it's exactly this or anything else.
Exactly. Next question is from Rich, which is a different, very different tone. What is your opinion on players who take fancy, distracting stutter step penalties versus those who run up and shoot? Bearing in mind, there's a correct answer.
It doesn't matter unless they don't score. It's my answer.
Yeah, I just don't care.
I only care if they miss.
Sorry, Rich, or Rick. I don't feel particularly strongly about it either way.
If it works, so, whatever. All power to you. I don't care.
Yeah, you can let us know in the comments. You can let us know the correct answer. But the only thing I'd add to that is I think the new rules that the goalkeeper has to keep on the line are terrible. They seem like a huge disadvantage to the goalkeepers.
Hey, gladly they did it after I stopped playing, so that's great.
Eric then asks, if you have time, I've only recently discovered that many clubs have a second reserve squad in the lower division. Is this an integrated farm system? Why is it that Bayern's second squad so far down compared to other clubs with fewer resources? Thanks and keep up the good work. Do you want to answer this one, Manu? So Eric's asking, why did Bayern have a reserve team in the lower divisions of the Bundesliga pyramid?
Well, it's part of the youth development scheme, right? They're definitely not happy that they're not, and they can be as high as the third division, right? That's the highest level, and it can only be, I think at the moment, there can only be 2 second teams in the third division. So they can't be more than that. It's, you know, essentially it's because for the other teams in the third divisions, playing against the second division teams isn't exactly a big attendance draw. And attendance is a huge thing for German football. For especially in the lower divisions, right? But you know, it really comes down to, so these second teams are by the most part, they call them amateure, which is like the amateur sides. They are mostly professionals and they're youth players who need a little bit more competitive football, right? Whether it's that in the fourth or the third division. But it's also actually like my club, 1860, has seven teams. They have a second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh. The second team is obviously mostly still the professional part of the professional side of things, right? And it's actually also in the club structure part of the first team. But the other teams are actually for, I think they play as high as the fifth or sixth division. And you can join the 1860. Of course, you have to make the team, right? But you can play for 1860 for one of those teams. And I think there's some other clubs in German football that have that too. And that's because these teams are membership clubs. And if you become a member, you can use all the club's facilities. You can become, you know, you can join their, I don't know, 1860 has like a boxing club. They have a skiing club. Bayern Munich has a bowling club. All this sort of stuff, right? So it's basically a mechanism to actually allow your members to be fully part of the club that they are members of.
Yeah. Only thing I'd add to that as well is that it's also great for youth development. In a lot of countries, they're still kind of debating whether you should have specific youth leagues or allow reserve teams and youth teams to play in professional leagues. And it's a pretty unanimous, I think, from just about every kind of person who works in youth development that playing in the lower divisions may seem like it's a lower level, but it means a lot more to development because these players are playing against fully grown men. They're playing in fully competitive matches. So it's only a good thing for these teams.
There's promotion and relegation at stake too. I think Leverkusen and Frankfurt experimented without their second teams and after a few years realized that was a stupid idea and brought it back.
Yeah, exactly. Brian asks, over the course of the 400 episodes, how have you seen your podcast change? And how have you seen the media landscape for English language Bundesliga content change? Manu, this is definitely a question for you since I wasn't here at the start of this podcast. I'll let you jump in and maybe I can answer the second part of that once you're done.
How have I seen this? Well, I mean, it was such a pocket podcast at first. Chris Williams and Bryce Dunn, shout out to them. They were a big part of this journey from day one. And we founded this podcast in 2017 and it was part of the World Football Index. I think it's just still around, run by James Knowlton. And then we joined the Anfield Index, which is a Liverpool fan podcast. We became sort of the German Bundesliga podcast branch. And then, you know, it grew from there. Eventually, Chris, Bryce and I decided to go independent. And I think that was around the time that you joined us as well, Stefan. And, you know, how has the media landscape changed? I mean, I came to football media via blogging, which I think is a lost art. Blogs are definitely gone. We have a Substack, of course, but there's real journalists in Substacks. You know, it's not like Substack is kind of replacing the newspaper landscape that is dying, right? But I came, I'm not a trained journalist. I have a PhD in history. I was supposed to become a professor and teach history at universities. And I came through this journalism basically self-taught and as a blogger and then started writing for newspapers in the US, right? That's how I got here. But I think that kind of path to journalism isn't really there anymore the same way than it used to be. I don't know. I mean, Stefan, your journey is a little bit different than mine. I don't know how your experience has been in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely has changed a lot since I was started off. I started off similarly, actually, as a blog. I actually started off, also didn't do journalism at university. I did engineering at university. But I was blogging kind of so extensively after high school and first few years at university that I actually started blogging for the New York Times when football or soccer was seen as this kind of jovial topic that could be just chalked up as a blogging subject. And some fantastic people there who really allowed a lot of kind of young names to kind of get their name out there. Through that I started writing for different magazines like 442, And then eventually, I actually dropped out of engineering and went off to do a master's in journalism. off the back of really just the sheer amount of writing that then turned into almost a full time job. Because from that, I actually started working for Bleacher Report back when they used to write content. And I was more or less, you know, a clucking chicken in one of their kind of battery farms or whatever they're called, just firing out content and listicles and things like that, which I hated. And then, you know, I worked my way up from there to working. And then I eventually graduated with a master's degree in journalism in Glasgow. And I've kind of been a professional journalist since then. But yeah, I completely agree with you. It does kind of feel like that avenue for blogging, maybe not as obvious as it once was, even though there are now things like Substack, which I think offer tools that we never had to blog, you know.
You can get paid now, right? Like, that's a huge difference. Blogs was not a money-making thing.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, back when we did it, Twitter was a different thing. When I started off on Twitter, it was a place where you went and presented your work and other journalists and other writers would read your stuff. They would leave feedback. They would retweet your work. They would tell their followers to go read it. There used to be such a thing as Follow Fridays, which is when you would recommend other writers and journalists and things that your subscriber or your followers should go follow.
Yep.
And Twitter just feels like something entirely different. Now, social media in general feels like something different entirely. And it's also the way that social media itself and algorithms have changed, that not only do they discourage you from sharing other people's work, but they also now discourage you from suggesting people should leave those platforms at all. So, you know, Twitter used to be somewhere where you could follow what your favorite writers are writing about. Now, you can't really do that so much. And also, you know, people nowadays don't really want to write about stuff. They wanted to talk about it in front of cameras or on podcasts. And hey, I would absolutely recommend that as well. I think if someone was starting off today and asked me what I should do, I would say start a YouTube channel before anything else. Work your way. It doesn't have to be amazing, but, you know, a YouTube channel that gets maybe a couple hundred views per video is as good as the blogs that I used to do as a young person. And you know, it might not get your job as a newspaper writer, but it will definitely open the door for you for a lot of multimedia jobs. In terms of the second half, that question is quite interesting as well, whether we think the English media, English language Bundesliga coverage is still as strong as it once was. And
no, it's not.
No, I totally agree with you. And, you know, I think putting on my gig in pressing hat, I would say that we've actually benefited from that simply because there's just a lack of coverage out there anymore. That goes from the very small independent blogs, which used to be everywhere when I started out, to the very top where big international football websites, which I won't name, more or less, you know, just don't even pay a huge amount of attention to any leagues outside of England. And that's not the writers' fault who work for those websites. I completely understand why they have it, because I've wrote about German football in the English media a lot, you know, for The Guardian or The Telegraph or for other newspapers as well. And I know that over the last 10 years, there has been a very, very strong shift away from, you know, hey, do you want an interview with this rising star in Germany? No, thank you. Hey, do you want to interview this player who's been linked with Man United or used to play for Man United? Yeah, that'd be great. And it always has to be focused on, has to have an English kind of angle on it, unfortunately, these days. So we could probably spend all night discussing why that's the case. But yeah, there's definitely not as much written coverage of the Bundesliga online as it once used to be, that's for sure.
I don't think analysis is as marketable anymore than it used to be. Well, maybe never was, but because the way the industry now works, it's all about chasing clicks, right? Which I think is a very short-sighted model that will bite these media companies terribly in the butt eventually. But, you know, it has led to even a certain outlet which describes itself as never doing this, doing transfer stories only as a blog, where they don't offer any analysis. And, you know, I do think that is a really dangerous path to go down, because eventually I think everything is going to go behind a paywall, right? And I also think that people will want to actually fully read stuff that is explaining things rather than just getting, oh, player X moved to club Y, right? Like, you can just go to Transfermarkt and find that statistic. Why would you even bother writing about it? So I just wonder if we're going down a path that is actually not even sustainable for newspapers, and newspapers chasing the clicks to survive are actually making the crisis worse. But, you know, I also feel like that to fully go through my thoughts here, we would spend the entire rest of the podcast on it.
Yeah, all we'll say is make sure to subscribe to Gegenpressing and to check the Transfermarkt homepage each and every day.
Yeah, so that pays all bills.
Next question is from David Hall, who says, if you could watch a live game with anyone dead or alive, who would it be? Also, if you could have anyone dead or alive one-to-one for an hour interview, who would it be? Cheers and congrats. I've actually got an answer for this one, Manu, if you don't mind me jumping in first.
I'd love
to hear your thoughts on this one. As soon as I read this, the first one that popped into my head for an hour-long interview would actually be Franz Beckenbauer. We obviously did the big long podcast on him after his unfortunate passing. And it's only when you kind of look over the course of someone's career or in their life that you realize just how many stories they must have. Never had the opportunity to speak to him. He was obviously quite a quiet individual towards the end of his career, or private rather. So that would have been a wonderful interview. And the one that popped into my head, which might make a few people laugh, is who would I watch a live game with? And I've actually come with Louis van Gaal, just because he's an absolute lunatic. He has that. I don't know if he had it at every club, but I specifically remember in his latter stage of his career, particularly at Manchester United, actually he had this huge clipboard, which he used to write down notes on. And yeah, I'd love to just sit next to him. I'd just love to sit next to him. Maybe not have his full attention, because he's obviously terrifying, but just to sit there and just look over his shoulder and just hear him muttering about things during a football game, I think would be fascinating.
I love Louis van Gaal, but I would be terrified to watch a football game with him. He's a brilliant coach. You know, I think that era is coming to an end, but, you know, the Bayern Munich golden age that we're seeing the tail end of, and now that's him, he built that. And it's a brilliant answer. Having lived in Amsterdam and knowing some, you know, his background and where he's from, yeah, he's a very, 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 very strong Amsterdam individual. That's a really good question. Who would I want to watch a game with? Is something that I had a really tough time answering. Is I love watching games with my dad. I still do to this day. But of course, doesn't quantify here. You know, maybe we'll stay with terrifying head coaches. There is Werner Lorand, 1860 coach. I think it would be very entertaining to watch a football game with him. You know, he's obviously has the Werner Beinhardt. He's a bit of a choleric. Actually, probably pretty similar to actually what Louis van Gaal was or still is. I think it would be very interesting to watch a game with. Franz Beckenbauer would probably be another one to watch a game with, because he obviously saw the game very differently than most other people. As for the one-on-one interview, I'm going to go with someone who's not a football player. I would love to do an hour-long interview one-on-one with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Because I think he's a super fascinating person. And, you know, what really strikes me about him is he had an impossible accent. All the odds were against him, and he made it big in America, you know. I walked a similar path when I was 17, 18 coming over here. And, you know, just to see that this is possible and that you can make it, I think is incredibly inspiring. And I think he's really underestimated in that regard because he became a millionaire before he became an actor. People forget that, right? And, you know, just whatever he did successfully, whether it was being a bodybuilder, whether it was businessman, whether it was he was a very successful governor of California as well, completely reformed that state, right? People forget that. And I think that it would be just really interesting to pick his brain on all the things that he experienced.
Yeah. I actually listened to an interview with him recently once with, I think it was on the Conan O'Brien show, on the podcast, and he talked about the issues he had with his father as well, who was an alcoholic and really quite mean to him and his brother. And that was one of the main kind of driving forces towards him getting out of Austria and, you know, becoming a star and making something of his life. Yeah, I completely agree with you. He's a really, really interesting character. So I think that'd be a great one. We've actually got a kind of nice way to round up the show. A nice question from Steve. He basically says, I mean, it's a long question, so I'll read it out, but maybe we can just kind of summarize. He says, congrats and thank you to both for covering the Bundesliga. I know I'm just another pesky Bayern fan, but I love your broader lens on the league. I'd love to hear your bigger thoughts on what makes the Bundesliga so different from the other big five leagues in terms of coaching, club management, tactical identity, history, German culture, etc. My wife and kids follow teams in the Premier League, Ligue 1 and La Liga, and I consistently prefer German football. Energy and goal scoring, less theatrics, fan engagement, all of it. Why do you guys love the Bundesliga and what makes it what it is?
Well, my answer is really easy. I didn't have a choice. I grew up in Munich. And at the time, there were two good Bundesliga teams. Yeah, I mean, that's quite easy for me. I'm what they call a child of the Bundesliga. I grew up watching the Bundesliga. It was on television. You know, it was actually, for me, the big thing was radio, Stefan, the Konferenz, right? Which I recently learned from one of our Substack subscribers that that's actually a model that they stole from Italy. But whatever, I still say that everything, the red zone and the goal arena and all that sort of stuff was invented in Germany for radio. I stick to that story. So that is my really easy answer. If you grow up with that around you everywhere, and you know, the Bundesliga has an enormous imprint on German culture, right? You know, Germany is very good at many different sports, but I would say that Bundesliga, if you name the top five sports, the first four are German football. So then everything else is kind of fighting for the scraps, which is not fair, but that's just the reality of it. So, you know, like, you don't really have a choice. But I, you know, I also do think that in many ways it is the most attractive football out there. Is it always the best? I would say no, but, you know, there is periods where it is. And, you know, that makes it, for me, the most fun league to watch.
Yeah, I think I completely agree. I mean, I got into German football just out of cold-hearted planning because I was starting out as a football writer. And at the time, everyone was covering Spanish and English football. And I thought, well, at the time, Italian football was more of a kind of reminiscent thing that your dad would talk about from Euro 90, the World Cup in Italy in the early 90s. Football Italia was a big thing in the UK. So Italian football was very much seen as something that had come and gone. Spanish football was in its heyday. English football was on the rise. And I had to basically pick a niche to distinguish myself. So I picked German football. And yeah, I absolutely ended up falling in love with it. I think a lot of people probably come to German football because it's a fun, exciting product on the pitch. Gegenpressing has meant that teams throw everything they have at each other. You know, from a tactical point of view, you can have your problems with it. God knows I do. But there's no doubt that someone who doesn't follow football or doesn't follow German football, you could put most Bundesliga games on a TV in the pub and people would happily watch it. Which at the time was something you did not say about English football. Certainly something you didn't say about Italian football. And I think that's also maybe why Spanish football took so much interest, because of the way they played. But anyway, that's a discussion for something else. So football itself, more or less, has always been entertaining. But I think the thing that people love about German football and why people around the world do adore it is because it has this hidden depth to it, which is the fan culture, which is the history, which is the sheer adulation the fans have for it. If we were talking about like a sci-fi book, we were talking about the lore of it, you know, the extended universe of it. It's,
yeah,
it's, you know, and it's why someone from, you know, Michigan can be an SC Cologne fan, because they feel that there's so much that they can just dive into. And the more you get to know each club, the more you feel connected to them, the more you feel you're part of a community. And I think that's why people do genuinely adore it. And I can completely understand that. For me, it's a job, and it's a professional interest. But at the end of the day, I know that, you know, I can go to games, I can enjoy the atmosphere, and I could always just kind of, you know, pick up one of Matt Ford's newsletters about fan culture and think there's
so
more
good.
To this.
So
there's
good.
More to this than just, you know, 22 guys on a football pitch kicking a ball about. And
yep.
I think that's why we stick with it as well.
It's, you know, people always, and I watch the Premier League. Obviously, I have to. It's my job. People always ask me, like, why don't you cover the Premier League? Why don't you talk about the Premier League more? Why? And people know this about me. I'm not a Premier League fan. I watch it, and I do appreciate the football at times. I think it's a bit too mechanical for me, Stefan, which is odd because that would be more of a German description. But, you know, it's kind of when I compare, and it makes me do this comparison. The Premier League is like the Marvel Universe. It's manufactured. And overplayed, and the Bundesliga is like Dune or Isaac Asimov books. It has depth, it has history, there is meaning, you know, there is layers to it that are deep. It's not a mass produced product. It doesn't feel like that. It doesn't feel, and it's odd because when I was younger in the 90s, I actually really loved Man United and the history behind it, but they whitewashed that so much, right, that it's not even, it's almost like they sanitize the product in a way, right? And that is something that we haven't seen with the Bundesliga yet. And, you know, the yet is obviously, or how are we going to go forward with the product is, of course, this existential question, because we, for the Bundesliga to set itself apart from the Premier League, it has to keep that somehow, preserve it. And that's really difficult to do. But that is always the thing that's what it makes it really difficult for me to fall in love with the Premier League. I watch it, I consume it, I see it, but it's just not there for me in terms of inspiring and, you know, providing storylines. It all just kind of feels like it's made in a Hollywood studio. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it's almost got to the point now where there's almost two different products which people can actually enjoy in different ways. As you said, you can enjoy a Marvel film and you can enjoy, you know, Blade Runner, was it 2047 or something, and
2048?
or Dune or whatever else, and
yeah,
you know, they're both movies and they're both on the same platform, but they're different. They're different genres, maybe that's the word we're looking for. Different genres, I think that seems like a very fitting way to end the show.
I think so too. That was fantastic. Sorry if we didn't get to your question. And, you know, obviously we're going to talk about the German national team in depth, because it is, I actually, Stefan, I think what's going on with Germany right now is fascinating. This squad that Julian Nagelsmann has been putting together, I think might surprise a few people. So I think we need to talk about it. So sorry if we didn't get to it. We will get to it, and the Kai Havertz question as well, because I think that's almost a separate thing. What's happening there, I think at the moment, is fascinating as well. So when I get to all of these things, also, if you have been listening from the beginning, thank you so much. If you have been joining us later, thank you so much. If you're joining us now and want to continue this journey going forward, thank you too. This wouldn't be possible without you, the listener. We hugely appreciate it. Even if it's, you know, we appreciate you whether you're a subscriber or whether you just listen to the free podcasts. It means a ton to us. So thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. 400 episodes, 7 years of podcasts would not be possible without you, the listener. So we really appreciate it. Stefan, I'm pretty sure you want to add to that as well.
I don't know if I can add to it. I think you took the words right in my mouth. It was a very fitting remark. And yeah, as always, you know, the fact that we can ask people for questions and we get, you know, 30-odd people asking really good questions, just it's fantastic. And yeah, here's to another 400.
Here's to another 400. We'll be back soon with more content. We will do, of course, review the Dortmund game and then the preview show later this week. So until then, auf Wiedersehen.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.